This is Lost and Found. I'm Jonathan Green. And this week, sin. The man who lies to himself and listens to his own lie comes to such a pass that he cannot distinguish the truth within him or around him, and so loses all respect for himself and for others. And having no respect, he ceases to love, and in order to occupy and distract himself without love, he gives way to passions and coarse pleasures and sinks to bestiality in his vices, all from continual lying to other men and to himself. Dostoevsky.
Mikey Robbins!
Jonathan Green! How are you, mate?
Oh, look, I am famished, frankly.
You know what? I'm always hungry, but I'm willing to follow your lead here, my friend.
Well, how about this place? It looks imposing.
Well, it does. I mean, let's see if we can give the old credit cards a scream.
Let's go.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Looking for a... Oh, okay. Right this way.
Thank you very much.
Let me tell you about our specials today.
Okay.
All right. So, carelessness is our first special.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had that last night.
Mm.
We've got a mild silliness if you're interested.
I like mine hot.
I'm always fond of silliness, but anything else?
Moderate flirting is always a good option. It's very popular with the patrons.
We might end up there. We'll have a look at that later.
And a slightly raised voice.
Mikey, I don't bet you. I was thinking something a bit. Stronger.
Actually, well, leave it to me. I've been to this place before. Excuse me, ma'am. Do you still do the seven Deadly Sins degustation menu?
Bien sûr.
Ah, fantastic.
Let's do that.
Superb.
Oh, lovely.
Superb. We'll follow your order, but trust me on this one, Jonathan. I think we might kick it off with some lust.
Excellent.
Toujours une bonne idée. Gentlemen, your lust.
Okay, Jonathan, trust me, I've been here before. What we have in front of us...
What is that, Mikey?
I know it looks disgusting. It's a lamprey. Now, if you've never seen a lamprey before, it's the ugly cousin of an eel and a remora. But when it comes to lustfulness, it's been considered an aphrodisiac since the Romans. In fact, Henry I, the son of William the Conqueror, died after eating too many lampreys at a feast to get himself in the mood, I reckon. But and it goes through to... Remember John Gay, the great Jacobean playwright and poet?
Of course.
Yeah, best known for Beggar's Opera. Well, this is how much they regarded the lamprey as making you a little bit frisky in his time. He wrote a poem called To a Young Lady with Some Lampreys. So as you cast your eyes over our first course, I'll read you some. It's about a young poet trying to get past a maiden aunt to give a romantic gift to a young woman. Why then send lampreys? Fie for shame. 'Twill set a virgin's blood on flame. This to 15 a proper gift? It might lend 65 a lift. I know your maiden aunt will scold and think my presence somewhat bold. I see her lift her hands and eyes. Why eat it, niece? Eat Spanish flies? Lampreys are most immodest diet. You'll neither wake nor sleep in quiet. And quite in France, particularly around some of the major rivers, the lamprey is still considered to be a rather erotic delicacy. So,
Disgusting.
I,
I'm sorry.
I must admit, any dish with 3/4 of the preparation time is about draining blood.
Yes.
It does separate the goats from the sheep, this one.
All I can say is I'm glad we've got 6 to come, because I'm not sure about lust.
Okay, no, fair enough. Look, I tell you what, I might get a doggy bag for lust and take it home.
I'm sorry to interrupt, gentlemen, but I've got your envy ready to go.
Oh, Mikey, already?
Now, this is a very simple course, and it doesn't look something that would make us think of envy now. But it's a pineapple.
It's a pineapple.
It's a simple... But you have to remember, Jonathan, that when, in like the late 15th century, when Europeans first came across pineapples, they'd never eaten any fruit that sweet in their life. Although... it almost got banned. Louis XIV, on biting into a pineapple, declared the fruit too dangerous to eat because no one had told him he should peel it first. But eventually he learned, not that he ever liked the pineapple, but he almost bankrupted the French court because he had a particularly beautiful courtesan who would only sleep with him if he gave her a pineapple. Now, growing a pineapple in Versailles was ludicrously expensive. In fact, this goes through the whole history of the pineapple until late Victorian times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you wanted to make your upper middle class friends jealous in Victorian London...
Pineapple.
But you wouldn't buy one because you couldn't afford to buy one. You'd rent one. Because, honestly, a pineapple in 1850s London was worth around about 10,000 modern Australian dollars per pineapple. It was cheaper to go out and buy a Meissen recreation of a pineapple than actually have a real pineapple. So you'd go down to the... you actually would go to a pineapple broker, put down a hefty deposit, and what you'd would have is what we have in front of us, a pineapple that your friends would all just gaze on in wonderment, and then you'd whisk back the next morning to get your deposit back.
They'd be getting a bit sorry by the end of a couple of weeks, wouldn't they?
Well,
out there on the party circuit.
it's always thing that people just don't treat rentals properly, do they?
They don't. Drive it like you stole it, that pineapple. Exactly.
Well, that's the thing. The pineapple broker would keep renting it out until it was ripe enough to sell. In fact, Catherine the Great was notorious for keeping pineapples almost to the point where they were rotten, just because she wanted people to admire that she was so wealthy she could get real pineapples in St. Petersburg.
I'd heard that about Catherine the Great, but I never believed it until now.
You know
now.
What? Every time I say the words Catherine the Great and pineapple, we have to change subject.
Get that pineapple out of your way, and I've brought your Roth.
Mikey, look at that. That's making me cross just to look at it.
It is a very simple, beautiful piece of Turin bread making. It's just grissini, as we know them, as breadsticks. Now, I'll get to the Roth bit later. They were originally invented for Vittorio Amadeo II, who was the Count of Turin, a young count, who had a very delicate stomach. So the court physician and baker created these. And in fact, they say that if you still go and stay in the castle to this day, the ghost of young Vittorio still haunts the place, holding a handful of grissini, which makes him probably the least terrifying poltergeist in Europe. So he's coming at me with baked goods. But here's the weird thing about grissini and Roth and war. They became an obsession of Napoleon Bonaparte's. Bonaparte actually built a private road from Turin to Paris to make sure that he got a fresh delivery of grissini every morning. And before he went out on any military exercise, he made sure that he'd stockpiled enough grissini.
Grissini freeway.
Exactly. He had the grissini freeway. And then before he went to battle, he'd stockpile enough grissini to get him through the battle. It was bizarre to think that he was eventually defeated by a man who we have a beef dish named after.
Well, at least it's a meal. Look, Mikey, I know this is your favourite place, and we're having it special, but
So far we've had a hideous fish, a bit of pineapple and a breadstick.
Well, I tell you what, to make the grissini go down a bit better, I'll throw in a little bit of camembert with it. Now, very quickly, I'll explain to you why camembert is part of Roth. After Normandy and the great breakout of the Allied forces into France, there were American small battalions who kept blowing up farmhouses because they thought they could smell something rotten in there and there might have been war crimes, until eventually the French convinced them, no, it's cheese! You're actually blowing up our cheese! Because think about it, you grow up in you know, in 1930s America, you've never smelled a camembert in your life. So just to make Roth more palatable, I'll order a side order of camembert to go with our grissini.
Wait a could we perhaps some camembert?
Absolutely. And I'm just going to brush these grissini crumbs out of your way as well while I bring you your next course.
Can we wait a moment for that?
Oh,
Mikey,
of course.
Mikey, can we just pop out on the terrace for just the jiff? Just,
oh, sure, mate. Yeah,
just a breath of fresh air.
A breath of fresh air, yeah. Don't mind if I do.
You look like a cheroot, mate.
Oh, let's put it like this. I'm more than 100 kilometres away from home, and does my wife know I'm... Yes, I'll have a quick, I'll have a quiet, I'll have a sneak.
Excellent. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's a dreadful habit.
Nice night, though.
It is lovely. It is lovely. Now, I should have warned you before we started that, you know, it is a commitment, the seven deadly sins degustation menu.
We've had our lust, we've had our envy, we've had our wrath.
Look, I promise you, things will get slightly more edible as when we return.
Oh, I should hope so. Let's pop back in then.
Okay. Cheers, mate.
Gentlemen. Oh,
thank you. Thank yes, you. Thank we're restored. Greed? Is that next?
It is next. Here it is.
Mikey Robbins! I am so sorry about this. Here I was promising you we'd have something wonderful. You would assume greed, we'd be having caviar, we'd be having... And in fact, what I've got is...
Possibilities are endless.
Yes, but what's arrived is a bucket full of oatmeal. Now, I have to explain this to you. When I think about greed and sins, I also think about people who don't like spending money, people who are a bit tight.
Yes.
Now, there's some famous tight diners. Charlie Chaplin never paid for a meal in his life. The Duke of Windsor never paid for a meal in his life. Cary Grant, the suavest actor in the silver age of Hollywood.
Don't tell me. Freeloader?
He used to get a pencil out and put lines on milk bottles to make sure his staff weren't nicking any of his milk when he turned his back. But the oatmeal, the bucket of oatmeal, comes from Hetty Green. Now, at the end of the 19th century, Hetty Green was the richest woman in America. She was a real estate developer in New York, and we all know how that ends up for everyone. Never good people. And maitre d's in New York restaurants were terrified when she'd walk in, because she would never pay the full price. She would argue and argue, to the point where, not that she got banned from restaurants, she just stopped eating out in restaurants. So when you saw her in the streets of New York, she'd be walking around. This is the richest woman in America, with a bucket of oatmeal, which she would then warm up on radiators of property she owns, and she would have that for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Can I just say that in an establishment as apparently opulent as this one,
I know
I'm expecting something a little finer than a bucket of cold porridge.
Well, I'll go and find
just
a radiator
quietly.
For you. I'll just go and find a radiator for you.
I'm almost inclined to go back to the lampreys. At least they were flesh.
See? You mocked the lampreys earlier. Now they're not looking so bad.
Waiter.
I've come for your buckets.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's probably not the first time I'll hear that tonight.
And I have brought your gluttony.
Oh, what on earth is that
thing? Jonathan, you are staring at the sandwich that killed Elvis. Well, one of the many sandwiches that killed Elvis. This is what's known as the Fool's Gold Sandwich.
It is extraordinary.
It is amazing. Elvis so loved the sandwich that one day in the early 70s, he got on the Lisa Marie, his private jet, and flew 8 of his mates.
Sorry, he had a private jet called the Lisa Marie?
Yeah, no, it's sort of weird when you... I'm pretty certain he named the jet after his daughter, not the other way around.
Okay.
So he climbed on board his private jet with some of the Memphis Mafia, his mates, and flew from Memphis to Denver, where they picked up 22 of these 8,000-calorie sandwiches. That's 8,000 calories per sandwich. Now, for
what
those
is
of you,
in that?
Well, okay. You start off with a loaf of white bread. Of course you do. You then cut it in half, and you smother both the inside and the outside with margarine. It was the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
You then put that into an oven where it gets crisp. While that's crisping up, you go to a fry pan and you fry, well, I'll use the old money here, a pound of bacon until it's crispy. So you've got the crispy bread, a pound, 450 grams in for the young folk.
Okay.
So you take out both loaves of bread. Now, on one, you put a whole jar of jelly, grape jelly. On the other one, you put a whole jar of peanut butter. Then it's a simple matter of putting the bacon in the middle, and you have the fool's gold sandwich. Feeds 8 or 1 Elvis.
Oh, really? In our case, 2.
2. Yeah, and the good thing about it, though, is you, if you do order it at this restaurant, they will throw in a side order of defibrillator.
Clear!
Yes!
That is the most disgusting thing I've ever eaten in my life.
Elvis could knock off 2 in one night. Because a lot of people don't know this, but by the time Elvis passed away, because the last footage we see of him, he's about 120, 130, he's chubby. But he'd gotten over to 160 kilos just before his death. And as someone who has actually spent some time of their life at that weight, it's not pleasant. And it also takes a fair amount of determination and this sandwich to get there.
Wow. I can just imagine getting off stage and hoeing into one of them.
Yeah.
You know, seems a very, 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 very Vegas thing to do.
Yes, it is Vegas. Have you ever been to Las Vegas? Seriously, they would deep fry water if they could.
Way to take. We've done well with this, I think, Mikey, but I think any more of that will kill us.
And I'll bring you a glass of milk in just a minute. But first, your pride.
Oh.
Ah, now see?
Yeah.
You're recognising what's in front of you, because we're around about the same age. Now, when I think about pride, I think about, like, my childhood, your childhood, as we're around the same age. And there was that era in Australia where dinner parties were trickling down the socioeconomic world. They were no longer just the exclusive world of the rich, and like a working class family like mine would have dinner parties. And there were new cookbooks, Margaret Fulton was coming to the fore, and we were getting little things that would make mum's cooking, because mum did all the cooking in those days.
Combiner on a stick?
Well, indeed. But I'm thinking what we used to call the little packet of pride, Campbell's French onion soup mix, which I have never had.
Is that what this is?
Yeah, well, you know, let me get to it. I've never had it as a soup. Now, Mum used to mix it with sour cream and put it out with some jats for when people arrive. But what we have here is the high point of suburban culinary cooking from the late 1960s, 1970s, apricot chicken. Now, it's a couple of chicken Marylands which have been fried off in the sunbeam. Mum only ever cooked in the sunbeam. And they get a bit of colour on them, then they get taken out. Then a packet of French onion soup mix from Campbell's has been added. A tin of apricot juice to deglaze the pan, as we would say in these fancier times. And then the chicken Marylands go back in, and then just as my mum would serve it, it's on a plate of buttered noodles, because remember in the 1970s, we only had two sorts of pasta, spaghetti, and everything else was called noodles. So it's my tribute to pride, this restaurant's tribute to pride, I'm sorry. It's this restaurant's tribute to pride. It's my mother's show-off dish from the 1970s, apricot chicken.
I've got to say that compared to everything else on the menu here, it at least looks half edible.
You know, right now in heaven, my mum's looking at you and you're going to tuck into that, young fella.
I'm going to tuck into this. Don't you worry about that.
Mm. It's not bad at all yet. Yeah. It tastes of nostalgia.
Tastes of packet soup.
Come on, 1972, this was cool.
Okay, that's probably... We've had a lust, we've had our envy, we've had wrath,
yes,
greed, gluttony, and mother's pride.
Mother's pride.
What's next?
Gentlemen, we've come to the final course this evening.
Yes?
It's sloth.
Oh, thank goodness
Enjoy.
For that.
Enjoy.
That's beautiful.
And perfectly enough, it's a packet cake.
Nice.
And the reason why they use sloth as an example of a packet cake, World War II was a great breakthrough in dehydrating meals that could then be recreated on the battlefield. From that technology, we also got the packet cake. Now, when the packet cake was first released after the war as an ode to sloth, the instructions said just add water.
Perfect.
Well, that's what you would think. You would think it would fly off the shelf.
Hmm?
But it didn't. And so they got some marketing people in, which is always a good thing, and they realised that there's something really primary about baking, particularly baking a cake. There's a sense of ownership that the baker wants to have.
Mm.
And they came up with a very simple idea.
You want to be involved in the process.
Exactly.
You want to feel like you've contributed.
Exactly.
You put a skill into it.
Exactly. You've done something that makes you feel like you're a cook. So they took out the dehydrated egg and said, add one egg.
Oh, no, suddenly, nothing says baking like adding an egg.
I know. That it's something as simple as primary as that, which gave the home baker a sense that this packet cake was actually in the tradition of the cakes their mothers and their grandmothers had made, or the bakers around them. And so this sense of ownership over what was basically a lazy way to make a cake suddenly meant that packet cakes flew off the shelf. It's one of the two things we got from World War II, that and the microwave.
The microwave from World War II?
Yeah, the microwave was actually invented as a way of a potential guidance system for missiles.
For hot beverages.
Well, what happened was the guy working on the microwave noticed that a nut bar, like a nut and toffee bar that he had in his pocket, kept melting every time he was near the machine. So he went. So you're not going to believe this. His first experiment the next day was to put some corn kernels on top of the machine and make popcorn, which 60 years later is still pretty much all we use microwaves for, apart from reheating.
Popcorn.
It took him years to get it perfect, but the first microwave came out in the 1950s. It was bigger than a modern fridge and it cost around about $20,000.
Wait, excuse me. Do you think we could perhaps inspire me, Mikey? Do you have any corn?
I think we do have some corn.
Oh, fantastic.
Excellent. That will finish us off perfectly. Oh, Mikey Robbins, I can see that, you know, this is a theme restaurant.
Yes, indeed. You've got to commit.
I'm somewhat reluctant that we didn't try the mild silliness.
But you know what? I think we might have snuck a little bit in.
Well, it's been nice to catch up anyway. What was your favourite? I mean, the lust was good. The envy.
Oh, look, for me, it's pride. In fact, if you are of our age, you can go online, and I'm not making this up. There are websites dedicated to aficionados of the 1970s apricot chicken dish.
We've had our deadly sins. We've had all seven of them. It's,
thank you.
It's quite something. I guess we should pay. And look, Mikey, my treat. I insist.
Waiter. Could we
have our bill? You've been listening to Lost and Found this week on The Seven Deadly Sins. You heard from Mikey Robbins, author of The Seven Deadly Sins, and your waiter was Buffy Gorilla. Producers are Mira Adligillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Selwyn Cousins and Chrissy Miltiadu. I'm Jonathan Green.